So we've got a few minutes now if anyone has the energy to, to ask a question after all of that.
Just make sure you have the microphone.
It is such a fair question and a good one, and I have to be a little bit careful, but it is what I would say is that their total benefits budget, and that includes paid time off and health care benefits, et cetera, was in excess of $1 billion a year, and health care was roughly 50-60% of that. And that's just the U.S. population.
Because of the heavy concentration of your employees in the Puget Sound area, did you ever look at the possibility of setting up your own healthcare system, a sort of Kaiser Permanente type operation?
We did. We have...
Because it's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. The good news is that in looking at that and whether or not we should develop our own, what we found based on benchmark data is that if you compared on a plan-by-plan perspective, so if you took the benchmark and said, if everybody else had the same plan amongst our competitors, what would their costs be and versus ours? Ours were lower. So there wasn't this compelling business case to go through the effort of developing infrastructure to support something like that. In part, I think it's because having that high concentration in a geographic area also gave us the opportunity to be good negotiators, right? A lot of practices were very willing to work with us on cost and price, et cetera. So.
We have had two, Microsoft and IBM, well, a global company. I'm curious to hear, Judy, talking about at the country level of across all the countries that you are doing, can you identify, have you looked at the business practices there or industry practices, and are there some good lessons to learn from who does the best and where to go from there?
Thank you. Here's, I think, the piece we can say from the study I didn't focus on, the profit at the bottom of the ladder, what's happening in the lowest wage workers. To me, more than anything, what was striking was the commonality as opposed to the difference. So we have companies in that in everywhere. So, you know, China, India, Peru, Norway, Ireland, the U.S., Canada, really wide-ranging economies and country sizes. And there was a single ingredient that was very similar and yet rare compared to other companies around them, not compared contrasting countries, which is they saw low-wage workers in the way that Jennifer and Cecily's companies see high-wage workers. So they were aware of the skill of their lowest-wage workers, and they could see the extent to which addressing their needs really increased their productivity, increased their commitment to the organization. And even in economies like South Africa with 25% unemployment, where they could readily hire anybody else, they recognized how much the knowledge base that so-called low-skilled workers, but that this great experience and knowledge they had of the company was valued. So that was really the common ingredient across. In terms of differences, the main thing I would say in differences is, you know, the difference between a company operating in a place like Norway where the overall benefit level is incredibly high. So they have to have a strategy to meet this very high global level and economically succeed. But they're not so much competing with other firms to have an even higher benefit versus a company operating in Australia, the U.S., or Vietnam, where it really was a competitive advantage to have better working conditions.
Kevin, if I could just... You all right? I'm interested in sort of the misperceptions that you were talking about, and I was just looking at my notes. You said there's a substantial gap between public perception and the material reality concerning jobs, and about how the significance of technological change is overstated. Can you expand on that just a little bit? I mean, what is behind that? How do these things become so misperceived?
Well, it's part of this argument about the way you represent change and how that is, you know, how that's differed now. What's new about new capitalism is the way it talks about itself, the way it represents its technological possibilities, the death of distance, and so forth. And as I say, systematically, if you have a mindset that is all motion and no matter, you systematically exaggerate movement and flows and so forth. So, but in terms of this mismatch, it has extraordinary consequences. If I give you an example, the housing market bubble, in my view, was just one of a series of bubbles we've seen since the early 90s. And one of the great bubbles that just went past without much noticing was the fibre optic bubble. The fibre optic bubble took place under the assumption that internet usage would grow 1,000% a year for several years. Internet usage would expand at that rate, which is just truly extraordinary. I mean, in the end, it was 40%, which is, you know, a healthy rate of expansion. But money piled in to the sector on the assumption of 1,000% expansion per year. As a consequence, fiber optic cables were laid enough to circle the world 37 times. You know, you had this extraordinary expansion of fiber optic cables that lie on the bottom of the ocean, and now in the year 2000, 2001, operates at something like 2% capacity. We have this extraordinary waste of, you know, of capacity based upon the most, you know, the most amazing, you know, amazing overstatement about technological possibilities. Now, this is part of, and Hal's used the expression, irrational exuberance. We've gone through a period, we're going through a period in which irrationality has been a feature of neoliberal capitalism. And we have a set of experts and business gurus who almost celebrate irrationality as a contemporary experience. Tom Peters talks about, you know, thriving on chaos in the nanosecond 90s and so forth. It's almost as if irrationality and the kind of misperceptions that we have are part and parcel of the world in which we are exposed to blind market forces, which are presented to us as a natural order of things. And I think if we wanted to introduce rationality to it, that should be challenged.
But that's always been the case with technology, hasn't it? Hasn't there always been a kind of exuberance about a new piece of technology and that is not based in... with the telegraph, for example, some of the things said about the telegraph, when it...
I think if you compare the discussion that people had about technology in, say, the 50s and 60s, and compare the tone, compare the, you know, the, as I say, the exuberance of the period, the discussion about technology in the 60s seems almost prosaic in terms of, you know, well, it's happening now. It's not generationally, you know, radically or qualitatively different from the past. And that was the tone. It was a sensible assessment about technological possibilities and output. Nowadays, it's of a completely different order and character, which, you know, extraordinarily overstates, you know, its impact and significance.
I'm just remembering this. I may have it a little bit off, but I read that it took the telephone 75 years to reach 50 million people, and it's taken the internet 4 years. So something dramatic is happening. Population growth?
Well, if you think about it, to have a telegraph and, I mean, transoceanic, you know, cables were laid in the middle of the 19th century. And I think that's an extraordinary achievement, for some considerable time ago. Internet, I mean, this is the symbol that we cannot see. It is the central, you know, if you like, invisible metaphor of the period. Yes, it's fantastically impressive. But if you begin to look at, you know, what what technology's impact on work, actually, it's not that much impressive. You look at the proportion of the workforce that are engaged in ICT development, the proportion of the workforce that is involved in ITC kind of usage, and the proportion of the workforce that is non-ICT, it is huge. Something like two-thirds of the workforce can be categorized as non-IT using.
Interesting. Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Just make sure you speak into the mic, if you will, please.
Another just sort of, I think, compatible perspective on that in social policy, and since you gave me Alan Greenspan credit for that, I'm going to take credit now for something Robert Solow said, another Nobel Prize economist, talking about social policy and why do we have these great aspirations for social policy. When we do evaluations, we find the changes are actually very small. You know, if you look at any particular program, you know, a 1% change is very effective. And it said, but it's very hard. You know, we sell programs as the great society, the war on poverty, but it would be very hard to sell a program as a small incursion on poverty, you know, as a small guerrilla war to try and improve health. And I think there's a certain social movement effect that in any change, you know, you need to, but it's part of the process of effecting even small change. There's a much greater buildup and social movement to it, and then these things take on a life of their own, which is part of, I think, the bubble psychology to it. So I think it's compatible with, you know, small numbers and great aspirations.
Do you want to add something, Jody?
I guess it's irresistible not to say something about whether all social policy just leads to small change. For sure, there are many programs that lead to small change, but I think we do have to remember there are enormous changes in society that have happened as a result of policy changes. Public education. The world was transformed by the availability of public education. When countries have successfully eliminated child labor, which many haven't, but those that have. I mean, there are many policies that have small changes, and we should value those that have small changes because they can make a big difference in people's lives. But there are certainly cases where we've, particularly where we've changed the floor, whether it's the education floor, the labor floor, or the social protection floor, where the impact has been dramatic.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize and underline what has been just said. Of course, I cannot accept that social policy has no major impact, and I just don't want to really argue a lot. I just want to put your attention to the fact that the Millennium Development Goals in poverty will be reached probably by most of the countries, and they were ambitious when they were set. So this is a significant reduction in poverty which has been achieved through policies that were focusing on this topic. Of course, in health, not everything will be achieved, but there are significant there is progress, let me say it like this, and this would not have happened without policies that were focusing on this.
So, yeah, we'll give it, you're going to give you have a moment.
I think the point was that the effect, you know, in any given year is 1 or 2%. I mean, it's oversold, and then, of course, in 10 years, you've got 10, 15%, and I think that's with most policies. You know, any population change, it occurs very gradually. It doesn't mean that it doesn't lead to significant change, but it's much, often much less than is promised, and occurs slowly.
Okay. Do you have a question?
Yes, Marc Dumont from Fondation Chagnon. About these small changes program, problem, I think this is the basic problem of making change in society. Because as we've seen for 2.5 days now, the problems of health discrepancies and the effects of health discrepancies are well known, well documented, in part of, due to the marvelous works of researchers like Dr. Marmot. But these health discrepancies have been documented for many years before, partly, but we know about it. We know about how they act on the quality of life, on health expectancies, and prevalence of disease and all this. We know these phenomena for a long time, but we also know many of the solutions, as we've been told for 2.5 days. There are solutions that are been implemented, tried, and declared valid. And there are hypotheses, quite valid, about what to do to reduce the health discrepancies. But we are still in a forum like that, seeing the state of the fact that these health discrepancies are still very high. So what happens? I think one of the problems could be that when the solution are presented to the population, or that they are marketed to the population in terms of social marketing or advertising, literally, the promises that are presented are so high in terms of the possible effect of this solution or this intervention, that when it comes to evaluation, the results are always deceiving or deceptive. Disappointing, sorry. People are like, oh yeah, so much money for so little, because you promised so much, so you don't give us what was expected. And then it falls down. And it comes to the problem that was marvelously documented by one of the presenters, Dr. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name, but the problem of scaling up the solutions. Solutions are known, but they are abandoned. Why? I mean, it's a tremendous sector for research. I think, of course, we still have to test the solution and make all the experiments and all this, but we have to document why the solutions are abandoned. And I think one of the answers of this extraordinary enigma is that when we market the solution or the programs and all this, we do it in such a way that people expect so much, and we know for a fact that changing the reality, the social reality, is slow, it's incremental, and it will be with small increments. And before, as long as we present things as we will change everything, from now it will be different because of our intervention, people will always say, oh God, only that.
I think that was Johannes Linneth from the Brookings Institution that was talking about, not only do we fail to analyze the failures, we fail to analyze the successes as well. Does anyone have, Jody?
I just want to make one follow-up observation about this, about the time frame for change, both in the public and the private sector. One of the things that was most striking in our Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder study, global study, was the extent to which privately owned firms that don't have to respond to quarterly reports and Wall Street and other markets around the world found it easier to innovate. Right, they were able to get the long-term benefits. We did find publicly traded companies that did, but they had to be the executives, frankly, had to be a lot tougher, a lot stronger, and be really willing to weather the storm. The longer-term strategy just worked, but you had to be able to be on that cycle. There is a public sector parallel to this. The 1% change a year, I'll tell you, I would grab that in a minute. You know, if we could count on 1% change a year in poverty, and I could know, maybe it's I'm old enough to realize that that's pretty fast now, but if we could count on a 25% reduction in one generation of poverty, that would be phenomenal. This has been a problem for millennia. But when it comes to politicians, if you're talking about that in their two-year term they're going to have a 2% reduction, that's practically nothing, and it's very little for them. They have a four-year term, it's a 4% reduction if they're lucky that they're in office that long. So it's very hard when the transition cycle for the policymakers is so much shorter.
I just wanted to add some comments also to the promising or promises of politicians and scaling up. I think in principle one has to make the distinction between policies and between scaling up market products and so on, because there are different structures behind. So if you scale up, let me say, successful policies that have been piloted and there is a kind of hope that they might work on a broader scale, the first and most important question which has to be posed is if the capacity of the government or other institutions is there to scale up such schemes. And the second question is not if things have been overpromised, but the question if the population has understood the necessity to buy in something like a health insurance or something, and very often this is not the case, and this is in all countries like this, and therefore in many countries you have mandatory systems because there's no time to lose to make difficult technical solutions understood, like risk pooling and so forth. So social health insurance, for example, is mandatory. If you have voluntary solutions, you have very often the situation that only those who really are at risk, they go in, so it will be a failure because there is no burden sharing. So the situation is, of course, different if you want to scale up a product in the market and reach out to I don't know whom, because the question is then not so much if the capacity is there. I think the firm or the enterprise will make sure that they have the capacity to produce more than or the sufficient number of these things. So there are totally different concepts behind, and I don't think that we can only blame the politicians. The question is also to make not just a good idea, but to ensure that there is a possibility to implement the things. And it is not only the question that the population is not aware or is not really focused on these issues, I think.
Okay. Hans has come in from fishing, so...
So I have to do a comment on this G8 aims, you know. I think it's really dangerous to talk today about when we will reach these aims. We doesn't have any database today what's happened after the post-crisis. We doesn't know how in fact the situation today, next year, in springtime, how many NGOs runs out of money, how many people working around the whole world and doesn't know how to go ahead with the work to reach the same. Every company where I'm connected, and this is a lot, believe me, doesn't know what's going on next year. If we stay today in this room, we will reach 2015 our aim. It's a very tranquil, positive situation at the moment, but all of us have to do all the efforts to don't have a big dramatic fallback in the situation what we have before 2000. So I think it's really dangerous to talk about and we will reach the aim at 2009 when we doesn't know the data and the basic and the factions and figures of the end of this year and the beginning of the next year.
Hans, was it you that mentioned yesterday that our institutions are on the brink?
I was mentioned, and I'm a strong believer we can make it, but it's dangerous to give us the feeling that we're on the way. We need all the efforts, we need all the concentration to stabilize the way where we are at the moment, and we have 5 years to go, and this is only a half of the game, you know, and all what I want to recognize, and it's a daily fight, and I know thousands of NGOs outside that doesn't know how to find the money for next year. I just come back from Ethiopia where I meet many, many NGOs. I have daily calls from the people what we can do about the social business aspect to finance our work. And these NGOs was the heroes in the last 8 or 9 years to do the jobs. It was basic on basic. It was citizen to citizen. That doesn't have any money more. The corporate and the many philanthropic capitalism is gone. So I just want to remind you that we have I'm seeing positive, but it doesn't give us a feeling to look forward. We will make it if we are middle in the process to fight the greatest catastrophe that's going on. This is what all
okay.
to remind.
Thanks. I think that's actually a terrific introduction of our closing keynote presentation.